Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
This is going to be such an exciting day. I hope you enjoy it. I think you will.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
That sounded like a young Cale Clark. I mean, it sounds like Cale Clark at like 17.
I wonder what Cale would say about you saying that.
Tell him.
I will.
Tell him I said so.
I'm going to tell on you.
Hey, looky, Ma, we got us a radio show. Patrick Madrid here. My number is 888-914-9149. I'm raring to go. I'd love to talk to you. And people are lining up. Lines are filling up as we speak, but there is some space available. So if you'd like to be on the air, give me a call, 888-914-9149. And we are going to be going to phone calls momentarily. First, though, a few emails. This one came in this morning. This is from Mike. He's listening on the Relevant Radio app. Thanks, Mike. And his question has to do with the vasectomy versus contraception versus NFP, which is an acronym for natural family planning. He says, I enjoy listening to your show every morning and greatly appreciate what you do. I have a question related to a call you received. Now, he says on today's show, so he must have written this yesterday. I only saw it this morning, but yesterday's show, from a man who said he had had a vasectomy. I understand that vasectomies and contraception are grave sins. How, though, is NFP different, seeing that with NFP you are purposefully engaging in the marital act only when you are fairly certain that pregnancy will not occur? All three aim at trying to achieve the same goal, avoiding pregnancy. Is NFP acceptable because it's natural and does not involve surgically modifying the body or introducing birth control or some other form of contraception into the marital act? Thank you for your time. Great questions. So first thing is just fair warning. This is one of those topics not suitable for children. Let's see, Cyrus, do we have kids holding
We're
on?
We're safe. Okay. We're safe on the phones, but those okay. at home.
Yeah. Exercise caution, please. And as you know, I mean, there's nothing graphic or purient or anything like that, but it's a topic that's not suitable for kids. So fair warning, ready, steady, go. So the three things are, you are correct. They do have the same goal to avoid pregnancy, but they are different means to the goal, two of which are immoral, one of which is moral. And that one that is moral is natural family planning. So not all means to an end are justified. And so let's kind of go in order here. So the question the gentleman asked yesterday was a vasectomy. And I had another email I'm going to get to in a minute from somebody who I wouldn't say rebuked me, but thought to correct me on something I said yesterday. And that relates to the same call. So we'll get back. We'll get to that in a few minutes here. So his call was, he said he had gotten advice from a priest saying that it would be okay for him to have a vasectomy because his wife has a delicate health condition and they almost lost her with the first pregnancy they had. And so the medical advice they were receiving was that if she gets pregnant again, she'll probably die. I'm paraphrasing what he told me. So we talked about the sinfulness of getting sterilized, in his case, a vasectomy. And the reason that that is wrong is because, as I said yesterday, it's a mutilation of the body for the purpose of avoiding the possibility of the transmission of life in the Marriage Act. And that's wrong. And the church repeatedly has said that each and every marital act must be open to the possibility of the transmission of life. And so anything that might be done, chemically, barrier, what have you, surgically, what have you, that would prevent the possibility of life being transmitted or procreation, let's put it that way, that the church says is sinful because it's a misuse of the marital act. It's frustrating. It's foreclosing upon the possibility of the Marriage Act achieving its natural goal. Doesn't mean it has to, but it means it has to at least be possible that that could happen. All right. So that's why we talked at greater length about the issue of vasectomies. Not a particularly pleasant topic, if you ask me, but it's something that's of interest to a great many people. So then So that's the surgical version of it. Contraception is the same thing, but it's being accomplished in a different way, maybe through a chemical or through a barrier. So we don't need to rehearse the reasons why contraception in one of those forms is wrong, because it's wrong for the same reasons that a vasectomy would be wrong. Now, pausing for a minute, let's say there was some legitimate medical reason. Let's say a terrible accident, or there was some other problem in which, you know, maybe like in the case of a woman, she has to have a hysterectomy, and perhaps it's due to cancer or something like that. Well, it's entirely morally permissible to undergo medical therapy, if it's a hysterectomy as an example, if that's what's necessary to help the woman survive cancer or overcome some other life-threatening disease. The church doesn't say that you can't have operations when they're necessary, but if the operation is being undertaken for that purpose, in other words, it's not to save you from cancer, it's not because you have an ectopic pregnancy and they have to remove the fallopian tube, it's not because of some other true medical condition or emergency, it's simply because you don't want to get pregnant, that's the circumstance in which this becomes gravely sinful. So what about NFP, this third option? Well, this is why it's so totally different from the other two. Even though it has the same goal in mind, you're not doing something sinful to achieve that goal. You're just simply not making use of something that married people have a right to make use of. They have the right to this pleasure in marriage, and God ordained it as such. And thank you, Lord, all the married people will say. But when you simply abstain from using it, you're not doing anything sinful. And I have, honestly, I have never fully understood how some people fall into this mistaken notion. I'm not saying that you have, Mike. I'm not saying that it's you, but I have heard people who have just fallen into this error of thinking that somehow natural family planning is the equivalent of contraception. It absolutely is not. I don't know how they can't see it. It's so clear and obvious, like fasting from food. If you're eating food just for the pleasure and overeating, that's gluttony. That could be an eating disorder, because that's divorcing the responsibility of eating food, calories, weight gain, things of that nature. We all have to take account of those things. Some people do a better job than others, but that's part of the responsibility of eating food. And eating food is pleasurable. We like how it looks. We like how it tastes. We think about what we're going to have for dinner. I mean, we all do. So if we can use food as an analogy, the equivalent of getting a vasectomy or getting your tubes tied and other forms of contraception is essentially you eat all the food you want, you enjoy it, and then you eliminate it from your body so you don't have to deal with the responsibility and the consequences that would arise from eating a lot of things. And you just simply now, it's just pure hedonism. You're just enjoying food for the pleasure of it, and that would be a sin. It's called gluttony. And that's not the only way in which you can commit the sin of gluttony. But point being, when you fast from food for the purpose, let's say, of weight loss, you're not doing anything wrong. I mean, if you fast too far, too long, you'll die, but nobody does that. So it's hard for me to understand how some people just can't see this, but I don't say this by way of a put down, but just to say, if you stop and look at this, you'll see, I think, rather clearly that natural family planning is, it's natural, as you say, Mike. It doesn't modify the body. It doesn't introduce chemicals or barriers or anything into the marital act. It's just simply refraining from the marital act until such time as, through charting and other observation methods, you determine that it's not likely at all that procreation would take place. Okay, so I hope that's helpful. I realize it's a topic that, you know, some people say, how can we talk about this stuff? By the way, there's a lady who has written me many long handwritten letters. And by the way, I do appreciate her name is Angela, by the way. Angela, I know in each of your letters, you tell me you're never going to listen to the program. You're never going to call. You're never going to write. And then I receive your next letter and I'm grateful for it. But Angela is an example. Sometimes she writes under the name Laura. She has different names that she uses, and that's fine with me. I don't mind. And I appreciate the time that you take to write to me. but she's an example of somebody who says, why do you talk about things like this? Well, the main reason, of course, is because the questions come up. People ask the questions. She says, why don't you just refer them to a priest, or why don't you just refer them to a doctor? Well, because I'm here. I'm here on the radio, and you're there, and you're listening, and people are interested, and there are a million and one things to talk about. This is one of them. So because it's something of interest to enough people, married people especially, and you would be surprised, Angela/Laura, how many people write emails on this topic. It's really phenomenal. So that's why I talk about it. I hope that's helpful. Now, let's go to the other email on the same topic. This is from Anonymous, and I do appreciate call or emails rather when you give me your name, at least so I know who, whether it's a man or a woman. But in any case, I appreciate this email, short and sweet, and it's about that call I referenced yesterday on the vasectomy, the guy who had a vasectomy. He says, good morning. You made an error regarding counseling the caller to go to confession. The caller did not have full knowledge of the sin, therefore it does not constitute matter of sin. The audience needs to know sin requires full knowledge, will, and consent. Thank you. All right. Well, I hate to break it to you, but that's not exactly correct. And I stand by what I said yesterday, but I will be happy to elaborate a little bit further. So when he called in, the man who called in, he called in because he himself was concerned about what he had done. So the context of the gentleman's call is he was concerned that he had committed a sin. And he said, and the priest told me it was okay. And the doctors said, if I don't do this, then if my wife gets pregnant, then she could lose her life, et cetera, et cetera. And I think as I recall, he was saying that some other people in his life were telling him that it was the right thing to do. But his conscience was bothering him. That's why he called. So the context is he was aware that there was something not quite right about this, and he wanted to know. In essence, what he wanted to know is, what do you think? Do you think that that priest gave good advice or not? Do you think this was a sin or not? That's why he called. So let's get to the essence of the mistake here that you made. And I say that with all due respect. Please understand. You don't have to have full knowledge of the sin for it to constitute sinful matter. In order to be, well, let me take a step back. A sin in itself, so let's just talk about a mortal sin, whatever it may be, or that particular mortal sin. When you determine the morality or immorality of an act, you triangulate using three points of reference. And you can do this with any human act. The first would be the object of the act itself. What is it you're doing? Is this in itself morally okay? Is it morally neutral? Is it morally evil? The second would be your motive. Why are you doing this? If you're sticking a knife into a guy because you're robbing him and you're stabbing him so he won't struggle and he'll give you his money, that's a serious sin. And your intention here is to rob him and hurt him. Well, if you're sticking a knife into a guy and you happen to be a surgeon and you're sticking a knife into a guy, of course, you might call it a scalpel. The circumstances and here your motive are entirely different. You're sticking a knife in the guy to save his life through an operation. And that's a rather dramatic example, but there's an example. The third point of reference that you bring to bear when you're examining the moral implications of a human act would be, what are the circumstances? So when you look at anything that you're wondering, is this a sin or is this not a sin? Apply those three things, and you can rather clearly and rather quickly come to a pretty clear determination if this is sinful or not. Now, the thing here is a sin can be understood from two vantage points. It can be understood, first of all, as an objective thing. In other words, is this sinful? The second way to look at it is subjectively. Are you fully aware that it's sinful? So you can commit a serious sin, and yet your culpability can be diminished if you're not aware that it's a serious sin, or if you're, you know, somebody told you that this is not a serious sin. So that would be the difference between, you know, the sin being materially sinful in itself, and maybe not formally sinful in the case of somebody who doesn't understand what's going on here. That's just one example of it. So to your point, you don't have to have full knowledge of the sin in order to commit the sin. You can still commit the sin. The question here, and maybe this is what you're trying to articulate, is to what extent is he culpable of committing that sin? And that's something that only God knows. So in confession, which is the whole point of why he called in the first place, is because he was disturbed by what had happened and he wanted to know, he wanted a second opinion. So this is why I told him, go to confession. Bring it up. Tell the priest. And tell him, by the way, Father, another priest told me that this was okay. Oh, okay, well, he'll take that into account because that obviously diminishes the man's culpability if he was getting incorrect advice from somebody that he thought he could trust, and so on and so forth. So you don't have to have full knowledge of the sin. You don't have to have 100% engagement of your will, which is the same thing as consent, in order to commit a serious sin. Your culpability will vary depending upon that. And so the formality of the sin, or your formal cooperation in the sin, I should say, could be greater or lesser in terms of its malice. Now, I think what you might have been thinking of is the issue of what are the constituent ingredients necessary to commit a serious sin? And as the church has always said, it has to be grave matter in itself. This qualifies. You have to have sufficient reflection. You have to have sufficient reflection. And he certainly had sufficient reflection because he went to a priest to find out, is this okay? He wouldn't have done that if he didn't have in the back of his mind that voice of conscience saying, that doesn't sound right, or maybe that's a sin. So why did he go to the priest? To find out if he could do that. So he had sufficient reflection. He did get bad advice, of course, so that mitigates things for sure. And you have to have freedom to do this, to commit a serious sin. And by everything I could tell from the conversation I had with him yesterday, it sounds like nobody was coercing him. And maybe he was getting sort of like, you know, peer pressure perhaps. And who knows what other kind of pressure from his wife or somebody else. So that can be taken into account as well. But ultimately, you and I can say, nope, I'm not going to do that. I hope that helps. And this is from Royal Lamb, which I know is not your actual name. I don't know your actual name, but just to make sure that you know that I'm responding to your email. I appreciate that. 888-914-9149. Even the Pet Shop Boys know that some things are a sin. Listen to this. 888-914-9149. I'll be right back.
Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Our sponsor, Christendom College, offers our listeners access to free online classes at getprinciples.com/truth. Acclaimed philosopher Dr. John Cutteback is teaching a class now, Understanding Human Nature, at getprinciples.com/truth.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Okay, back to it. Let's go to Laura now in Northern Idaho. Good morning, Laura. Thanks for waiting.
Good morning, Patrick. It's a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you. Likewise.
Thank you. My question is in regards to some family friends of ours have asked if I would be a sponsor for their daughter getting confirmed.
Okay.
But it's in their, they attend the SSPX church. Mm-hmm. And so because of its irregular situation, I have pause about it and just wasn't sure if it would be advisable or not.
Yeah, I can understand why, because of the, you know, the peculiar circumstances surrounding the SSPX. That, by the way, is an acronym for the Society of St. Pius X, for the sake of those listening who don't know what that means. And as long as I'm at it, I might as well let people who don't know what that means know that in the years after the Council, Vatican II, there's a very traditional archbishop from Switzerland, Switzerland. I think it was, I'm actually forgetting where Archbishop Lefebvre was from. I know his seminary was in Econ, Switzerland. But in any case, he was a Francophone bishop, European bishop, I think French. And he wanted to preserve the traditional rite of the Mass in the wake of the Vatican II changes to the Mass. So the new rite of the Mass that emerged in 1965 and beyond, he didn't really like that. And so he wanted to maintain these traditional forms. So he had a seminary in Econ, Switzerland. He ordained priests. And that was sort of the status quo until in the late 1980s, he let it be known that he was planning to ordain four of the priests of his Society of St. Pius X to be bishops. John Paul II, who had known that this was coming for some time, he warned him ahead of time several times, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. He wound up doing it. This was in 1988. And so Pope John Paul II, he issued an admonition, in essence, announcing that Archbishop Lefebvre and the four men that he had consecrated to the episcopacy were excommunicated thereby. So that put the status of the group, the Society of St. Pius X, into question. So if the founder had been excommunicated because of this act that Pope John Paul II said was schismatic, and these four men who are now consecrated bishops, if they were excommunicated, what did that mean for the adherents of the Society of St. Pius X? What did that mean for questions like the validity of some of their sacraments? So the strange thing is that even though these excommunications were lifted many years later, the actual status of the SSPX remains uncertain. And canon lawyers and bishops and others have wrangled over this and debated over this. And I myself am not entirely sure if anyone has come up with a conclusive answer. The popes have not said, Pope Benedict XVI and currently Pope Francis have not really said anything specifically on the issue. So it's kind of like in limbo right now. And so they operate outside of the lawful structure of the church's hierarchy. So they don't recognize or accept the lawful authority of the local ordinary, the local bishop, and they have their independent chapels, and they don't answer to the Catholic Church institutionally. They answer to themselves. They answer to the remaining bishops who are, you might say, running the show. So in recent years, Laura, back to your question, it has added, I guess, in a way to the uncertainty, because Pope Francis, for example, has granted faculties to SSPX priests to hear confessions. There are other things like that that seem to suggest that they're in a more favorable state than other people might think. And I just don't know. So to your question, is it okay to be a sponsor for somebody who goes to an SSPX church with all of that background taken into account? Personally, I myself wouldn't do it. But I don't think there's anything that I can see in any case that the church would say you can't do it, because it's such a peculiar and ambiguous situation right now. So I'm assuming you would be like a confirmation sponsor for a girl who's going to get confirmed. Would it be something like that?
Yeah, that's what they've asked. And the family is sympathetic to the fact that I might not be able to accept given their church's circumstance. So
yeah. Well, I would refer you, so I would say this, my best estimate of an answer to your question is that you could. I myself would not do it because I wouldn't want to, I am sympathetic to some of the goals and some of the ideals that are held by the SSPX people. You know, I don't wish them any ill. I'm not anti-SSPX or anything like that, but in my experience over the years, there's a sort of a palpable contempt for anybody who's Catholic, or they call themselves Catholic, but if they go to the new Mass, they have contempt for those people. They have contempt for so many aspects of the Catholic faith. And we could debate, you know, whether or not those things that, like the new Mass, you know, we could debate the merits and demerits of these things, but that's not what you and I want to do in any case. So I myself don't want to support something that doesn't need my support in any case. It's going to stand or fall regardless of what Patrick Madrid says or does. But I wouldn't want to personally support something that, in my view, is harmful to people insofar as they wind up developing a kind of contemptuous attitude toward the rest of the Catholic Church. Now, that's just my own, you know, perspective. It's anecdotal. It's my own experience, for what it's worth. But here's what I would like to do. So I guess I've given my answer to your question, but what I would like to do is refer you to Father John Zuhlsdorf. Are you familiar with Father Z, as he goes by online?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So he has an article, he has actually many articles on his web blog, What Does the Prayer Really Say? And he's got several that are really good in terms of clearly analyzing the status of the SSPX. I think he's very even-handed. He's very generous, let's put it that way, in his interpretation of things in favor of the SSPX. So even though I myself kind of pull in the other direction, he, I think, gives a very helpful look and answer to some of those kinds of questions. So I'll just read you one thing from an article that he wrote in, when was this? September of last year. So he says, with regard to aspects of the status of the SSPX, he says, first, the SSPX isn't doing anything other than what was done before the council. Next, the society is not in schism, nor is there an excommunication on members of the SSPX. They are not outside the church. When there is an emergency of faith, the canonical legal aspect is secondary, and the first priority is the faith, the truth, and the liturgy, and all this which the church always kept, as it was in the 4th century during the Arian crisis. So he says, the anomalous and slowly evolving SSPX situation is complicated. When things are really complicated in the church, we are, in charity, bound to cut people some slack and interpret restrictive laws as strictly as possible so as to give people maximum latitude, which is why I was saying earlier, I don't see why you couldn't do this.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the view that he's proposing, and that seems reasonable to me.
Okay, good. Yeah, I'll definitely take a look at his other articles as well, just to get a little more familiar with that.
Okay. Yeah, and it's What Does the Prayer Really Say? That's his blog.
Okay. Well, Patrick, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks for your patience with my long-winded answer, too. I just thought it was necessary to give a bit of background, because some people are saying the SS what? What is that? All right, let's go now to Rowena in Tampa. Good morning, Rowena.
Good morning. I have a comment and a question.
All righty.
My comment is, thank you very much for telling me it's Pet Shop Boys. I think the last couple of times you've been playing it, I thought it was Depeche Mode.
It sounds like it could be Depeche Mode, doesn't it? Kind of an early Depeche Mode. But this is Pet Shop Boys.
Yeah, thank you for clarifying that for
me. You're welcome.
My question is, someone told me that when we make the sign of the cross top to bottom, left to right, that's the Roman Catholic way.
Mm-hmm.
But if we were to do it from top to bottom, right to left, that's the Byzantine Catholic. Is that true?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, or maybe even more commonly, the Eastern Orthodox way of making the sign of the cross. You'll also notice another small distinction is that typically Latin Rite Catholics like us, we, you know, put your hand out, so like your hand is flat, palm down, and when you raise it to your forehead, we touch our forehead typically with the fingers sort of side by side. The Eastern Orthodox will join the forefinger, the index finger, and the thumb together. So those three, like a little tripod, and you'll see, when you see that, you know you're dealing either with an Orthodox believer or a Byzantine Catholic, an Eastern Catholic. And that's the way they make the sign of the cross. And that invokes the hypostatic union, and it invokes the Blessed Trinity, three persons and one God. So it's a beautiful custom as well.
And what is the significance of the difference between the two?
I've heard different stories. And I don't know if, you know, I don't know if anyone really knows anymore, but I've heard people say, well, it's for this theological reason or that theological reason. I think it's just a custom. And it became prevalent in the Eastern lands. In the Western lands, it was more the way we do it here. If you really want to get some like a defined opinion, you can go on the Orthodox websites and just look it up. You know, why do you make the sign of the cross this way? Because there are different theories about why they do it. So I've encountered different explanations for it. I'm just not sure that any one of them is the reason. I think it's really more a matter of custom.
Just a custom. Okay, so there was no right or wrong answer. We're not doing it wrong, basically.
Oh, no.
They're not doing it wrong.
No, yeah. Neither one is doing it wrong. We're glorifying God and giving thanks and praise to the Blessed Trinity and Jesus Christ. So whether you do it the Orthodox way or the Catholic way, at least you're making the sign of the cross, which is great.
Very good. All right. Well, thank you so much for clarifying both.
You're welcome, Rowena. Nice chatting with you. And it sounds like we may have a new Pet Shop Boys fan. First Pet Shop Boys song I ever heard was back in the 80s. It was called West End Girls. Never heard of the Pet Shop Boys before that, but I did like that song. Let's go to Frank now in New Jersey. Hello, Frank.
Hey, Patrick. I went to a family memorial mass over the weekend. My brother, who's in a same-sex marriage, went up to receive communion. I'd like to give him a call, you know, and in a loving way explain to him why he should not have done that as a Catholic. He is he's not from New York. He does attend Mass, I know, every Sunday in his home state. So I'm sure he's doing the same there. So I'm in fear of his soul, and I'd like to convince him, you know, not a good idea. So yeah. I wonder if you give me some pointers when I give him a call.
All right. Well, I mean, the locus classicus, as they say, for this topic is in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, the second half of the chapter, where St. Paul describes, first of all, the tradition he received from the Lord about the Last Supper and what was said and done at the Last Supper. He himself wasn't at the Last Supper, as you know. So he's teaching the Corinthians this tradition that he had taught them orally first, and then he's setting it down in writing as a reminder. Now, in that passage, in that latter half of 1 Corinthians chapter 11, he gives two warnings. He says that you should eat and drink not eat and drink when you are unworthy, because you are guilty of the body and the blood of the Lord. This is as I always say, it's a euphemism for murder. So he's saying if you eat and drink unworthily, you're basically re-crucifying Jesus. It's a very stern warning. So then he says, and anyone who eats and drinks without discerning the body, or you might, other translations say recognizing the body, eats and drinks judgment upon himself. And that word for judgment there is also a way of describing damnation. So in verse 27, when he says, whoever eats or drinks the cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner is guilty of the body and the blood of the Lord, let a man examine himself and so eat of the bread and drink of the cup. For anyone who eats and drinks without discerning the body eats and drinks judgment upon himself. Then he says in verse 30, this is why many of you are weak and ill and some have died. So the context here is warning. Don't receive communion if you are unworthy. Now, truly, obviously, all of us are unworthy. None of us is truly worthy to receive the Lord. He condescends to us in such an amazing way, and we're not really worthy of him. But what he's referring to here, without using the term, is being in the state of grace. So if you're in the state of mortal sin, and it sounds to me like your brother sort of habitually living in that state, given the circumstances, then he's being warned here in the Bible not to receive communion. And if he says, well, you know, I don't really care what the church says, I want to receive communion because I think it's nice. Well, in the next passage where it says, if you eat and drink without discerning the body, that not only includes the reality of Christ's body, blood, soul, and divinity, but it also includes the reality of the body of Christ, and specifically the church. And if you don't recognize the authority of the church and you are consuming the body and the blood of the Lord with impunity, it says that you're guilty of damning yourself. You're eating and drinking judgment, damnation upon yourself. Now, none of this may make any dent in his mindset. I don't know, but it might. And so if nothing else, you could at least share with him and you could say, I love you. I want you to be happy. I'm deeply concerned because you're receiving Holy Communion. And even though I know you don't think you're in the state of mortal sin, you are. And it's not for me to judge. It's for the Lord to judge. But the Lord has said that, you know, we should live in a chaste, pure way. And you're not. And so when you go to communion, my concern for you, brother, because I love you, is that you're harming yourself even further. And here's the passage in case you're interested in looking at it. What do you think he'd say?
I approached him about his situation. I have told him about courage within the Catholic Church and everything to that effect as far as the organization that helps people with same-sex attraction. You know, he has put that off and everything to that effect. But again, I'm gently trying to guide him to participate in an organization. So perhaps there's hope, you know.
Yeah.
Grace, you know, would be that. Can you tell me, are there any Catholic, you know, I just want to hit him with, you know, shock and awe, if you will.
Yeah.
So with the, you know, with the Bible and any Catholic doctrines, you know, I know there are, but, you know, maybe in the catechism or something to that effect. So I could hit him, you know, with a few.
Well, you could give him a copy. I would give him a copy of the catechism because there it talks about, I mean, it extols the virtue of the virtues of purity and chastity, among others. It explains them. It talks about what they entail and how we're all called to holiness. Everybody's called to holiness. It's not just certain groups of people. And we all have to strive for this holiness by God's grace. And in the midst of the extolling of virtue and the excellence of living a virtuous life, it talks about how you can fall short of that. And homosexual activity is one example of that. And it identifies it as an intrinsic disorder. And some people, they get offended by that. And I suppose I might be offended if somebody said I was intrinsically disordered. But it's maybe you can think of it this way. I don't know if this analogy will come up in your conversation with him. It's like a satellite dish. When the satellite dish is dialed in and is aimed exactly at the point in the sky where the satellite is, even though you can't see it, you know it's up there, you're going to get a crystal clear picture on your television. But if the satellite dish is slightly off, the more off it is, the more fuzzy the picture becomes. Now, if it is just completely turned in the wrong direction, it's not even aiming anywhere near that satellite, it can't do what the satellite dish is intended to do because it's completely miscalibrated. It's disordered. It's not ordered toward the source of what it's supposed to get, namely the movie that you want to watch on TV. So it's disordered in this sense. It's turned away from its proper goal, its proper purpose. When human sexuality becomes turned away from what it's rightly ordered to do, it can't accomplish what it's ordered to do, and it will wind up destroying itself, as anything is when it's misused in a way that's not according to its purpose. So that's what he's going to encounter in the catechism. They won't use the satellite dish analogy. That's something I find helpful. But when you're talking to him, you can say, you know, the Lord loves you, and he wants you to be happy. And everybody has different sins and sinful tendencies and predominant faults and things like that. This happens to be yours, okay, but you can overcome this, just like the alcoholic can overcome his sin or the serial adulterer heterosexual can overcome his sins. We all have sinful tendencies and we have temptations, and you're no different than anyone else, and Jesus wants you to be in heaven, and he wants you to be happy, and you're not. Your satellite dish is not aimed where it needs to be. And the catechism and the Bible and the church can help you reorient that. It doesn't mean that you won't necessarily have those temptations or that you'll cease suddenly now desiring something. It doesn't mean any of those things. It just means that with God's grace, you can overcome those barriers and challenges that would prevent you from getting to heaven. So it's love based. It's affirmative. It's loving. It's compassionate. It's, you know, some people take the condemnation approach. I don't think that works very well. But in the end, that's ultimately what will happen if somebody insists on saying, I want to do what I want to do. Oh, well, that's not going to get you very far in the end, but I don't know. I guess I'm rambling now, but those are thoughts that come to my mind if I were in your position. Some of the things I'd try to bring up.
You're not rambling. Those are very good points, and I appreciate it. And I'll bring that up.
Here's a book. I'll leave you with a book recommendation. You're welcome. The book is by Father Benedict Groeschel, Groeschell. And the book is called The Courage to Be Chaste. It's a good book. He was not only a Catholic priest, but he also had, I think his PhD was in psychology.
Where am I supposed to get it?
Any bookstore. Any bookstore. Or you can get it online. So The Courage to Be Chaste by Father Benedict Groeschel. Here we go. Pet Shop Boys again. I like it. Thanks, Frank. I'll be right back.
To free online classes. Our sponsor, Christendom College, offers our listeners access to free online classes at getprinciples.com/truth. Acclaimed philosopher Dr. John Cutaback is teaching a class now, Understanding Human Nature, at getprinciples.com/truth.
At the intersection of faith and culture, The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, we're back. 888-914-9149. That's the number to call. We'll get you on the air. Sean in Santa Clarita, California. I think this is the second Santa Clarita, California call this morning. Good morning, Sean.
Morning. How are you, Patrick?
Doing well,
Okay, next. About the sign of the cross, I used to lecture on the cross and how it started as an instrument of torture. But I also go into the history of making and signing the cross to our in liturgy. And it started with making it first with the thumb, as you, I'm sure you know.
Tracing the cross on your forehead, for example.
Right.
Yeah.
But around the 400s, it began. And it was originated in the Orthodox fashion, from right to left.
No problem with me.
And it wasn't until around 1200, so with Innocent III, that it became standard in the West to be left to right.
That sounds about right.
So I thought you and your listeners might want to know about that.
Well, that's kind of you. I appreciate that. You said you were lecturing on. On the cross? I mean, was that a topic?
I've given lectures on the cross, on all sorts of things. I began in 2005 when Pope John Paul made that the year of the Eucharist.
Mm. Admirable. It's nice of you to do that. Were you doing that at parishes?
Yeah. Yeah, here in Los Angeles area.
Well, that's cool. Well, I appreciate you adding that little bit of info. That's helpful.
It's my pleasure. I'm happy to do it.
Thank you, Sean. Thank you. And I hope that those atmospheric rivers are done with California for a while anyway.
Yes, indeed, for a while.
It's nice and green there, though, right now, isn't it?
Oh, it's remarkably still green. Usually by this time it's gotten brown.
I know. Well, we count our blessings where we find them, don't we? Thanks, Sean. I appreciate that. While Sean was speaking, I accessed a comment from St. Cyril of Jerusalem on making the sign of the cross. And by the way, St. Francis de Sales, he wrote a helpful little book called The Sign of the Cross. It's published by, who publishes that? That's Sophia Institute Press. And he gives 15 reasons why making the sign of the cross is good and proper and something that all Christians should do. Part of his reason for writing this was in response to John Calvin, who was, by that point, Calvin was dead, but St. Francis de Sales was a priest and then eventually a bishop of the area that Calvin had controlled in the modern day east of France in the Geneva area. And so many of the people who had previously been Catholic had gone over to Calvinism. And it was a really difficult thing for St. Francis de Sales when he was a young priest. He was about 27, 28 years old when he was assigned to this area once it became legal again to become Catholic. And he met with tremendous opposition from these hardened Calvinist people who a couple generations earlier were Catholic, but now they were very anti-Catholic. So a large part of what Francis de Sales did over the course of his many years of ministry was he did apologetics, and he met head on those challenges and arguments and claims that were made by John Calvin and his acolytes and followers and things. And this was one of them, because John Calvin had told the people that this papist Romish custom of making the sign of the cross, this is just sort of religious gibberish and it's superstition and all that. So St. Francis de Sales, he rose to the occasion and he destroyed those arguments, and he showed why 15 times over. It's a really good, holy, Christian, biblical thing to do. So if you ever want to go deeper into the meaning of the sign of the cross and all the things associated with it, that's a good little book to get. It's called The Sign of the Cross by Francis de Sales. So here's what St. Cyril of Jerusalem had to say on the topic. He says, many have been crucified throughout the world, but by none of these are the devils scarred. But when they see even the sign of the cross of Christ, who was crucified for us, they shudder. And scared, I should have pronounced it, not scarred. The devils are scared, he says, not by those other crucifixions, but by the cross of Christ. They shudder, he says, when they even see you make the sign of the cross. For those men died for their own sins, but Christ for the sins of others. For he did not sin, neither was guile found in his mouth. It is not Peter who says this, for then we might suspect that he was partial to his teacher, but Elijah who says it, who was not indeed present with him in the flesh, but in the spirit he foresaw him coming in the flesh. For others only hear, but we both see and handle. He's referring to Jesus in his flesh. Let none be weary. Take your armor, he says, against the adversaries in the cause of the cross itself. Set up the faith of the cross as a trophy against the gainsayers. For when you are going to dispute with unbelievers concerning the cross of Christ, first make the sign of the cross with your hand. The gainsayer will be silenced. Be not ashamed to confess the cross, for angels glory in it, saying, we know whom you seek, Jesus the crucified. That's from Matthew 28, verse 5. Might you not say, O angel, I know him whom you seek, my master. But I, he says with boldness, I know the crucified, for the cross is a crown, not a dishonor. Let us not then be ashamed, he says, to confess the crucified one. Be the cross our seal, made with boldness by our fingers on our brow and on everything, over the bread we eat and the cups we drink and our comings in and goings out, before our sleep, when you lie down, when you rise up, when you are in the way, meaning on a journey, and when you are still. Great is that preservative, referring to the sign of the cross. It is without price, for the sake of the poor, without toil, for the sick. Since the grace is from God, it is the sign of the faithful and the dread of devils. For he triumphed over them, having made a show of them openly, referring to Colossians 2:15. For when they see the cross, they are reminded of the crucified one, and they are afraid of him who bruised the heads of the dragon. Despise not the sign of the cross because of the freeness of the gift. For this, rather, is to honor your benefactor. Flowery language, but hard-hitting too. So don't be afraid to make the sign of the cross. And by the way, just a little recommendation, when you're out at a restaurant, I'm not saying do this to be showy or ostentatious, not at all. But when you're out at a restaurant, make the sign of the cross. Say grace. Bless us, O Lord, and these thy gifts, or whatever form of grace you prefer. But make the sign of the cross. Cyrus, I think you've heard me tell this story before, now and again, but I'm going to tell it again. So here goes. I was in Chicago O'Hare Airport many years ago. This must have been 25 years ago.
Yeah, Patrick, tell us.
All right, I will, if you'll be quiet. These voices in my head. So I was in Chicago O'Hare Airport waiting to change planes. I had a layover, so I had time to get some lunch. So I go into the restaurant, and this is just outside of the G Concourse for all of you road warriors. It's where in the American Airlines terminal, where the The regional jets typically come and go out of the G concourse. So there's a restaurant kind of right outside of that. And I went there for lunch. And I don't really remember anything about it. Couldn't tell you what I ate. But I do remember that when it was all done and I packed up my laptop and I'm getting my stuff, getting ready to leave to go catch my flight, a guy comes over to me and he was seated three or four tables away. And he comes over to me, says, "Excuse me, are you Patrick Madrid?" And I was a bit startled because, you know, you don't expect somebody to pick you out of a crowd like that. And I said, "Well, I am, as a matter of fact." And he says, "Well, I'm, you know, my name's Joe Blow and I'm a Catholic. And I thought that might be you. And I wasn't sure, but when I saw you make the sign of the cross, I knew it had to be you." And I, you know, I just do it out of habit. Don't do it to show off to anybody at all. But it made an impression on him. And he actually told me, he says, "You know, I don't normally make the sign of the cross or say grace when I go to a restaurant." But he said, "When I saw you do that, it reminded me that that's something that I should do." So point being, you never know whom you're evangelizing. You never know. It could be one of the wait staff. It could be a patron sitting at a different table. It could be somebody having a really difficult time right now. Maybe somebody who's even thinking about suicide. It could be anything, anybody at any time. And you won't know maybe until the other side of this life. But something as simple as showing your faith in Jesus Christ and his victory over sin and death on the cross. And when you make that sign of the cross in faith, not only is it a blessing for you, but it's a witness to others. You may not be the kind of person who would go door to door talking about Jesus. I'm not that kind of person either. But you can make the sign of the cross in public. That's a great way to evangelize. I'll be right back.
I like your style, dude.